Whether you're looking for answers to specific life questions or seeking to become the best version of you possible, welcome to the Mental Breakdown and Psych Reg podcast, where we offer insight, information, and strategies based upon research and years of practice as clinical psychologists. So sit back, have a listen, and get connected with our hosts, Dr. Bernie Wilkinson and Dr. Richard Marshall. Welcome back. Today's podcast is an interview that we did with Dr. Leslie Korn.
Right.
Richard, this is among my favorite conversations, my favorite interviews that we've done so far.
If your time is limited,
yeah,
start with this one.
Yeah. Because this is one you definitely want to check out.
Right. This woman really knows what she's doing. She knows what she's talking about. And she's just a joy to talk to.
Right. Mm-hmm. And we are working. We're going to have to get a map, like, for the back here that where we put little pins on it of people that we talked to, where they are. Because we've talked to somebody from Australia, New Zealand. We've talked to several from the UK.
U.S.
And now we have someone from Mexico.
Mexico and Central America, and she's been all over the Central America and Mexico.
Yeah, so she has a fascinating story about going to live in the rainforest of Central America, and then returning to attend the school called Harvard, get a couple of degrees.
Well, it was nice. We just recently we interviewed another, or we're going to interview another person from England, Hadley.
Right.
And he's done the same thing. He had these personal experiences and then pursued his degree.
Right.
And Dr. Korn has done the same thing. She had personal experiences and then went back and pursued the degree. It's a wonderful combination of their own life experiences combined with their academic work.
Yep.
But she's really, really good.
Yeah. She has two degrees, two graduate degrees, one from Harvard Medical School and one from Harvard School of Public Health.
Right.
And she has combined her life interests and her degrees to a profession of looking at nutrition related to mental health.
That's right. Because she went to these cultures where they don't have the sophisticated medical, so they have to rely on the ingredients that are available, as we did for hundreds of thousands of years.
The local botanical flora.
That's right, the botanical flora, the flora that's there. And that's what got her interested in this whole thing. Then she came back and combined it with Western medicine for a fascinating perspective. This was really an interesting, informative hour spent with her.
Absolutely. So we'll have a link in the show notes to all ways to follow her, because she not only is she still working and doing her clinical work with all of this, but she's also writing. She has a couple of books coming out, cookbooks. It's great
very
stuff.
Impressive.
And her writing is easy to read and very informative. It's great stuff.
And there are so many people who do these cookbooks and write this stuff, and you don't know whether what they're producing disseminating is accurate. Hers is.
Yeah.
I mean, what I love about this woman is that she has really taken the time to learn. And the combination of the flora with the medical gives her a credibility that many people in this field say they have.
Yeah.
She really has it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So check out the show notes for all of that information on where to get her stuff and where to follow her work. And you will not be disappointed.
No.
So I hope you enjoy the interview. If you have questions, this is yet another person that we are certainly going to have
on again.
She was a great interview, and we just barely scratched the surface of some of these things. There was so much more that we could talk about.
And she has another book coming out soon.
Right.
So we're hoping to talk to her after that one's out. So she will be back.
She will. Mm-hmm. So, all right. So enjoy the interview. Please write to us with any questions or comments or thoughts. Mm-hmm. So, all right. Enjoy.
Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Great. Great to see both.
Nice to finally see you face to face.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Tired of looking at you on a book jacket.
That's right.
Good to see you. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. I think I'm probably enjoying some nice, hot, muggy weather like you are.
Where are you?
I'm in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico.
Oh, you it probably similar. That's right.
Yes.
Is it we're having a monsoon season here, so
This ours is about to begin.
right. Plenty of hot and humid to go around.
So now tell me, who's who here?
I'm Bernie.
Bernie.
That would make me Richard.
That's Richard.
Richard.
Right.
Okay, very good.
Yeah, it's great to meet you. We have been we've been talking about your book. The one that we have, I'm gonna
Yeah,
reach
shut up
for
here.
it. We got this one. We got that book, and we've been going through it and talking about it for days. And what's funny is that you and I had been emailing back and forth, and we would talk about, having the interview and kind of meeting up and everything this month. And I was on Amazon and I was like, you know what? Oh, look at this book. I'm going to buy this book. And so I ordered it and everything. And I was like, wait a minute. That name is familiar. And it was your book.
Right.
So,
Oh, that's great.
but yeah, we've been talking about it. It's been fantastic. There's
Oh, I'm so glad.
so much information in it. It's yeah,
We've
it's
written a
fantastic.
couple of books, and I have to tell you, this is pretty dense. I commend you because we know what it takes, and this is just chock full of information. So,
Yeah.
Oh,
you have my,
well.
is this like the first edition of many, or do you have others going?
Well, if you want to see dense, you should read my book on trauma. Now, that's really dense. I
Is it
thought
really?
this was a little lighter,
Come
actually.
on now.
Well, there's so much information in each chapter, and we'll kind of get into some of it, of course, and of course talk about your new book, but there's just so much information, and I know it's written for clinicians, but man, there's so many pages in it that you could just kind of go through with patients and with those that we're trying to help with some of this stuff. It's just great information,
Yeah,
so.
I read when I first started reading it, I got to about page 13 and I said, okay, Bernie, I'm taking the book home and giving it to my wife. So we're gonna have to order more copies. I got that far into it and said, I need all the first 13 pages.
Oh,
So
good.
thank you
Well,
for the wonderful
well,
book.
thank you for that. Really warms my heart. And I did write it just for you, mental health clinicians who want to get into this, because I think it's the real missing piece for us in mental health. And actually, my two next books that actually came out, the one that I've sent to you, Eat Right, Feel Right, is this little book about this big, just chock full of recipes and designed for your clients
Okay.
with
Oh,
just
perfect.
little nuggets of information that will help them, but mostly recipes that they can use that are totally different from the recipes in this one. And then in September, a new book, The Good Mood Kitchen, is coming out. And that's also really took this book, and as you say, it added a little space to it, a little spaciousness, so that our clients could really make use of the information.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah, we've been trying to guide them through that. So that's going to be very helpful because we each have several right now where we're really taking really using this approach. Everything else has failed, and we're convinced that this is their problem.
Yeah.
So.
I'm with you with that. Yeah, what I say, and I really believe this, that it's 50% of our work. 50%, yes, we've got to process and go through the emotional affective stuff, but if people are drinking a lot of soda pop and crap, then
Yeah.
it's
Well,
just that's one of my questions this
yeah,
morning,
yeah.
as a
Oh,
matter of
yeah.
fact.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So I
Right.
want to talk at length about that one.
Yeah.
So
Okay. Well,
yeah.
great. Thank
Thank you
you.
for anticipating that one.
Yeah, because we, I remember it back when I was first getting into this field, and I wrote about this and some of the things that we've been writing and talking about, that I didn't really buy into a lot of the stuff that people talked about, because back in the day, all the talk was, if you had sugar causes ADHD and all this, and as you get into it, there's some things about it, if you're only looking at it at the surface level, that just don't make intuitive sense, because, well, again, on the surface, sugar is a stimulant. We treat ADHD with stimulants, so why would that cause stimulants? And once you start getting into it, you start realizing, wait a minute, there's a lot of connections with a lot of different things that we're eating and that we're you know, exposing our system to that probably is creating some problems.
Right. Absolutely. And you're right. And I think that's the key thing that we'll talk about too, that it's very individual, just like we don't do that with our clients in psychotherapy,
right,
nor do we do that in nutrition. It's got to be very individualized.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let's start off. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do, how you got to this wonderful marriage between mental health and nutrition? Tell us how you, that journey.
Well, I'd love to. It really began, you know, when I was in my early 20s, I hightailed it down to the jungle of Mexico.
Wow.
And I got sick with absolutely everything there was to get sick with. And isn't that the best laboratory for learning about yourself? Mm-hmm. And so I learned from all the local indigenous healers about the use of plants and natural medicines. And that really was something that was the start of my, what ended up being my career. I'd been introduced to meditation and yoga and also Chinese medicine as an undergraduate. And as you can tell, I'm from Boston. And I was very involved with the early feminist movement of the 70s with Our Bodies, Ourselves and self-care. Mm-hmm. And it just made sense that as I was exploring my own self in the jungle of Mexico, where my first round there was for 10 years, I married this idea of healing and self-care and women's health. And I also at this time trained in body work. That's my original discipline. And I practiced body-oriented psychotherapy for, well, over 40 years now.
Wow.
Well, now, wait a minute. You, one doesn't just go to the, you didn't go to Puerto Vallarta. You went to the jungles of Mexico?
I did. I went, at the time, we're losing the jungle quickly, but south of Vallarta, there's a stretch that back in the 70s and 80s, still quite rural, quite jungle. It's called the tropical dry forest. And no roads, no electricity, no running water.
Wow.
And
honestly, 10 years.
I just fell in love with it.
10 years is not a 4-day vacation. It's not a 4-day week.
Oh no! As a matter of fact,
10 years.
10 years, and then actually another 15, and so I've been down here. I ran a public health center in the jungle for 25 years that was devoted to natural medicine, and so it was really the process. I trained in body work. I trained in polarity therapy and cranial sacral therapy. And that was part of what we offered at the center, along with really conventional tropical health care. And it was the process of touching people and listening to people's stories that led me to the study of psychology. And so the first things that became wedded were actually touch, body work, and psychology. But the training that I did was in Ayurvedic medicine, and that was rooted in vegetarian nutrition.
Right.
And so that was a very early influence, along with the learning that I did with indigenous healers who are using plants and foods for healing in a location where there was no doctor. So I got to learn trial by fire, and that's how I considered every damn illness I had was my own personal laboratory. Could I heal a staph infection with garlic? We read about it in the literature, but does it work? Mm-hmm. And then eventually opened up a health center, and we were treating children with asthma through natural means and dysentery, you name it.
Wow. Wow, that's fantastic. I mean, talk about, you know, finding your calling the really direct way, the really life experience way. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. Now, was it your studies in college in professional school that led you to some of those interests, or were those interests from earlier in your life?
Yeah, I think they really evolved organically. When I arrived in the jungle, I'd actually hated school and dropped out of undergraduate school and really went in search looking for myself. You're too young to remember the 70s, but you know, that's what we did in the 70s.
And he's too young to remember the 70s.
I was looking, pointing at him. Yes.
Yes, thank you.
With the I know you and I, you and I both remember.
Thank you. Yes, we
and,
do.
And so I studied comparative literature as an undergraduate. Whatever it was that led me on this path, it really turned out to be what my life calling and career turned out to be. After the first 10 years in the jungle, I felt like I'd exhausted everything I knew about running a health center. And I was very interested in tropical medicine. And I went back and I got my first master's in cross-cultural health psychology, where I could integrate some of these interests, and then stayed on and did a master's in public health, where I was able to study the role of tropical fruits in the treatment of intestinal illnesses. So I had lots of intersecting interests around culture, medicine, and nature. For me, nature is the core issue. How does nature help us heal? And how do we realign ourselves with the rhythms of nature, with what nature offers us in terms of foods, to restore our physical, mental, and emotional well-being? So that's been the major theme that's informed my work.
You know, as you're talking, this is a tangent. As you're talking, it made me think about my grandmother. Do you remember the influenza epidemic of 1919?
Mm-hmm.
She lived in a small village in Pennsylvania, first generation, and she was the healer. She had a garden, and she grew herbs and raised things, and she would go from house to house treating people with influenza and from after World War I. Yeah. And I've heard stories about it, but I never saw her do it, but I've heard stories about her doing that.
Oh, wonderful stories, I'm sure. Yeah. That's how we healed. I tell my university students who are interested in studying all of this area that we're all involved in, I say, just remember, we've been healing each other for thousands of years before there were degrees to certify us to do so.
Right.
It just puts in perspective. And indeed, my grandmother and great-grandmothers were healers too. I think there were people in the communities who were chosen to do that.
Yeah, I always thought I've always thought she was a witch doctor or something, that they really didn't want to tell me the whole story. But as I got older, I realized what she was doing was using herbs to heal, to treat, because there were no doctors around.
Right.
This was the only
Might indeed have been a witch. Yeah,
well,
to inquire further.
When she started, when she got older, we were convinced that she was.
Well, you know, and this reminds me a lot of a experimental psychologist, neuropsychologist that I worked with at University of South Florida. And we were pretty good friends. And I would go over to his house sometimes and we'd go out by the pool and he would have plants that I'd never seen before. And he
Doug.
And he would get seeds from different places all over the world. And he was growing because he was very, very interested in, you know, the medicinal use of different plants that, you know, cultures from all over the world used to manage and to treat and to prevent illnesses and everything. So it's amazing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I always thought it was very interesting because, you know, he would have stacks of papers, stacks of articles on his desk. And whereas everybody else in the department, it's all, you know, from neuroscience and everything, his would be from anthropology, looking at some of these different things. It was fascinating. So now, you were looking at, well, you had these experiences with these physical illnesses that you were looking to treat, you know, through the different means and while you were in the jungles. It's weird to say that you were in the jungles, but while you were in the jungles, how did it get to mental health? Was that just sort of a natural progression for you, or were there other issues or other things, experiences that led to that?
It was. Well, I when you ask about other, I'll tell you that the town that I'm from outside of Boston has more psychotherapists per capita of any place in the United States. Wow. So was that a subliminal influence? Who knows? However,
I vote yes.
really, I came to this work as a body worker, touching people. And I know in Florida, cranial sacral work is very big. I trained in Ayurvedic medicine and in polarity and cranial sacral. And as I touch people, I remember one of my first clients who I had, she was a 65-year-old woman who'd grown up in a convent in Brazil. And she came to me with a very spastic trapezius shoulder muscle. And she was in tears. It was so contracted. And as I very gently touched her and asked her to breathe and release, outpoured the tears. And she began to remember what she'd forgotten, which is that she'd been raised in a convent. And at 12 years old, she had this memory just as I went in with my thumbs into this spasm, that she had been chastised by the nuns for her posture. And they took a broomstick and they pulled her shoulders back and put the broomstick between her elbows behind her and made her sit in the corner for 3 hours. Now, she had forgotten that particular experience, but her body remembered it. Mm-hmm. And I think the other revolution in healthcare, and particularly mental health today, is the way body stores trauma. And so working with people and touching their nonverbal memory for really thousands of hours of it led me to want to be able to help them process it verbally as well, not just nonverbally through touch, but I wanted to understand it. And that led me then back to, I did my clinical training at Harvard Medical School in a very conventional psychodynamic psychology program at Cambridge Hospital. And I learned obviously quite a bit about the conduct of psychotherapy. And then I was able to really integrate and find a way to think about what became my work as a traumatologist, to do body-oriented touch and talk at the same time.
Wow, that's fantastic. I mean, you've really integrated a whole bunch of different things there. I mean, between the touch, the psychology of things, the traumatology, again, just an interesting and unique marriage of a lot of different disciplines. So when we think about some of these different conditions, and, you know, as we're looking at modern man here in the United States, we have, you know, more and more mental health conditions. In reality, I mean, if we're going to follow some tangents outside of mental health specifically, more and more physical health issues that are becoming majorly prevalent. I mean, it's just over and over and over again, we're seeing these same things. It sounds like you're of the perspective that much of this is caused by our diet and what we're exposing our bodies to, from your experience and from your training and everything.
Absolutely. And not only from my experience, but I think the literature will bear this out too. And I think one of the important influences of having lived in the jungle for those years is that it really oriented me toward the role of culture and indigenous traditions and traditional diets. And I know these days it's very big to look at, let's say, the idea of traditional nutrition or paleo nutrition, the idea that if we, for example, ate like your grandmother ate, would we be as ill in these chronic diseases as we are today? And I think there's no question with the revolution in understanding the relationship between the mind and the body that we're really seeing two sides of the same coin. We've long recognized the intersection between depression and pain, colitis and anxiety, fibromyalgia. We very rarely see fibromyalgia without a history of chronic exposure to trauma in childhood. It so disrupts the immune system, the endocrine system, it's the neurotransmitter system, that it ultimately leads to a breakdown of the body's capacity to function to sleep, to manage pain. We see it in our treatment of substance abuse, the very high rates of substance abuse among people who've been traumatized. So I think there's a very profound connection between physical distress and mental distress. But our failure for most people is that we don't help them understand that connection and then what to do about it. And certainly nutrition is a major approach to treatment.
Before we leave this whole notion of trauma, you're familiar with the ACEs study, right?
Yes.
Okay. I have a couple of when we talk about trauma, it doesn't have to be profound trauma, does it?
It certainly doesn't.
Because I have a little boy now who was, we don't think he was ever physically abused, but he was neglected. There was profound neglect for the first 14 months of his life. And we have not been able to get him back. He's now 8 or 9 years old and nothing works with him. I mean, he is completely resistant to everything we've tried. So a little bit of neglect, a certain amount of neglect will do the same thing.
Neglect is profound more. And especially when you think about developmentally what occurs, that's the preverbal state of being held too. Mm-hmm. With a client like that, I've worked also with a lot of children on the autism spectrum. Mm-hmm. I use touch with those children, or like when we think about the extraordinary trauma of that neglect that we see in children who were adopted from other countries and who've lived in orphanages without touch or that eye-to-eye connection, that profound.
And he does, at one point, we did hypothesize that there were some autistic-like tendencies. He doesn't make good eye contact, avoids touch, except to be physically aggressive. But you're right, he had many of those same symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that we're really coming to understand, and particularly its influence is making headway in primary care where it's so important, the role of these adverse childhood events on chronic physical and emotional health, even diabetes. We tend to think of diabetes as a dis-ease of nutrition, and indeed it is. We don't see diabetes type 2 prior to 1900 when sugar began to make its real show in our diets, 1930 or so. But really, diabetes begins as a stress disorder. And this is also related to why minorities are often more vulnerable to the development of diabetes, not just because of poor food security or food access and potentially sedentism from having to do a lot of jobs. And I don't think it is a genetic issue. It's really about the stress of being a minority in the United States too. Mm-hmm. So there's so much complexity to what affects our stress management system and then how it manifests in physical illness as well as emotional illness.
Right. Yeah, one of the things I tell my patients is, you know, our body responds to stress in a pretty predictable way, generally speaking. But as sophisticated as our biological system is, our body can't differentiate where that stress comes from.
Yeah.
And so if it's stress from a knee fracture or if it's stress from, you know, your mom yelling at you, stress is stress from the body's perspective. And so when you're eating things that cause stress in your body or when you're experiencing life events that cause stress, your body's just experiencing stress. And when we don't manage that stress, when we don't respond to that stress or treat that stress and address the stress the way we need to, that chronic exposure has sometimes long-term effects. So, yeah.
Absolutely. And I think building on our discussion of trauma, I think we also have a kind of social dissociation. It's not just dissociation that comes out of traumatic events where people aren't always living in their bodies, but the work that you're describing where you're educating clients and we're all educating our clients to kind of integrate and feel what it is they're feeling. I think socially we're conditioned to think of our body and mind separately. Just look at the pharmaceutical commercials that come on the screen that ask people to go to their doctors and find out about a medication. People aren't always encouraged to pay attention to how they're feeling and then respond to themselves as loving, caring, compassionate caretakers. They're often taught, I think we're conditioned to kind of bang ourselves on the head with a hammer and say, come on, get in line here, take this medication and respond already.
Right. Yeah, I think that people would prefer to believe that they have a physical ailment than, of course, a mental ailment. But they would also prefer to think that there's a medication or something that you can take rather than change your diet or change some lifestyle, life choice. I'm not sure where that psychology comes from. I'm not sure why. Well, I'm sure it has something to do with sort of an immediate remedy or immediate gratification. Oh, here's a pill you can take. I'm just going to fix everything. You don't have to change anything. The status quo can continue, but that really seems to be the case with a lot of the people that I work with.
I think it's conditioning. I think we've been conditioned to believe that. Mm. Just like you remember when Prozac came out in 1988, that has driven this whole myth of neurotransmitter imbalance as the cause of depression. Low serotonin is the cause of depression. And now I see when I'm working with my interns who are coming up in the field, this complete buy-in, with the exception of maybe a few free thinkers, people are conditioned by what they're told and educated about or what media says to believe. Yeah. And until people have extraordinary experiences that make them doubt it, like maybe it doesn't work for them or they get side effects or any number of things happen. You know, look at the oncologists who, when they're diagnosed with cancer, choose not to have chemotherapy, or the cardiologists who have heart attacks and say, now I understand how poorly people are treated in the hospital. I'm going to change how I do things. Sometimes right. It takes that personal revelation to kind of undo that conditioned response.
Yeah. Now, when you talk about foods, you're actually talking about foods as a healing method of healing, but it's also what we should be eating every day. And I guess I have two questions. One is, I'm shocked that there are so many people who don't know what foods are doing to them. I think of all the people who drink soda. We should never drink soda, ever.
Right.
It should just,
ever.
It should be banned or something. I don't know. But we should never, yeah. But yet, is it safe to say most people do? And there are people who drink large amounts.
Right.
I mean, bottles of soda every day. So my first question is, a person can't be healthy and drink that amount of soda. Is it possible? Are there people who are immune to these sorts of things?
Well, I do think it's true. First of all, I absolutely agree with you. We should never drink soda. That's the right. first thing. That's one of the first things I help my clients eliminate, and I find alternatives for them that satisfy their need for the sweet or the bubbly water, which is often what it is, or the caffeine that can be in it too. So I agree with you there. And the other thing is that diet soda is even worse in some ways than the sugared soda because it so disrupts brain function. And so on the other hand, I have seen some people and they come into this world with an inordinate amount of vitality and a strong constitution, and they can debauch their whole lives and live until the ripe old age of 90, drinking and drugging and soda and you name it. Mm-hmm. And they go out that way too. Now that's the rare person.
But that's the outlier, right? I mean,
that's the outlier.
Right.
But you're absolutely right. I think the main problem with sugar, and I think this gets to your question when you referred to ADHD, is that it's highly inflammatory.
Yes.
And so if it's one thing, think about if we stub our toe. It hurts, it smarts, the toe swells up, and lots of cells and blood and oxygen go to the rescue of that hurt joint. And within a few days, the cells move out, they're eliminated, and the toe begins to heal. But taking in sugar every day like that is like stubbing your toe every day. You never give the body a chance to eliminate that inflammation, and it's like having a slow burning fire going on in your body. And that's one of the main causes of the relationship between depression and heart disease as well, because our very tender walls of our arteries become nicked and inflamed, and it's just this constant underlying inflammatory process that's now been linked to dementia and Alzheimer's, now called diabetes type 3.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Depression, the new model of depression is inflammatory
response.
Yeah. So I think that's where sugar brings problems.
Right.
And if you look at what cultures have to teach us about sugar, you're in Florida, sugar haven of the world. How do people traditionally eat sugar? They eat sugar on sugar cane. You chew on a sugar cane, and it's balanced with fiber, with B vitamins, and it's all part of a whole plant that nature has given us to give us a little sweet, but that fiber slows down absorption of the sugar, the B vitamins counteract any inflammation, and it's just the right balance for us.
Mm-hmm. Right. Sugar beets.
Yeah.
Sugar beets.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I talk to patients, about coming off of sugar, cutting back on sugar, one of the things I tell them is, you know, when you feel that sweet tooth coming on, you know, just eat some whole fruit. It'll satisfy the sugar craving, but it has the fiber. Don't drink juice, fruit juice or anything like that. But, you know, if you eat a whole fruit, because it's going to give you the fiber and the extra vitamins to slow that process down, but at the same time, manage that sweet tooth for you.
Yes, indeed. And so many of our clients are addicted to that powerful taste.
Right.
And that's part of the benefit of what you're doing, is helping them recognize that they're used to these profound hits of salt and sugar. Mm-hmm. And it's not unlike our clients who are used to being exposed to heavy stress. They really have to detox from that powerful stressor, really, that they're used to responding to.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
A quick question. Well, not a quick question. How do you explain to people exactly what the human biome is? Because this is a foreign concept to most people, yet it's absolutely essential that they understand what it is. How do you explain that to them?
I explain it like their neighborhood.
All right.
And I teach them, and I love to use metaphors when I'm teaching my clients about nutrition. So the biome is like our neighborhood, and particularly the center of our neighborhood is our gut. It's our intestines, mm-hmm. where all kinds of people live. That is bacteria, fungus, all kinds of microbes. And in our neighborhood where we live, we want to have a good balance of good people who get along together. We support them, i.e. support them with good food, like fermented foods. We nourish them. We do things for them, and we introduce them to other people. But occasionally there are mean people in our neighborhood, i.e. bad bacteria. And if we have too many mean people, that is too many bad bacteria that take hold, then it overwhelms the good bacteria, the good people. And so that's the kind of metaphor that I use with people. And then I talk about how to support the good bacteria in their gut, the kinds of foods that do that. And also what affects the bad bacteria, like what causes bacteria and fungus to grow, like sugars, or the effects of antibiotics. And I think, as you pointed out earlier, one of our biggest problems is the massive overuse of antibiotics in really disrupting the microbiome. So that's a little bit about my approach as I educate them about the microbiome. And not only is it in our gut, but it's in our skin. And so when I'm working with people who have eczema or psoriasis or acne, and we know there's a very high correlation between those skin diseases and depression. Right. And it's bi-directional. And so I work with them to improve their whole microbiome in this manner.
I have a patient now who had, a young adult, had severe acne on his back and chest and neck. And he went on either a ketogenic diet or a carbohydrate-free diet. And within weeks, the acne was gone.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He always had a band of acne around his neck when he came in. And he came in one day and it was gone.
Yeah.
And it was about 3 weeks after he went on the diet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very.
And he's convinced.
Indeed. And we, absolutely. There's, I've seen it clinically as you have, and I've also seen it in the literature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. Another thing I recommend in these areas, and hopefully this is consistent too, is a lot of times some of that is contributed to by heavy diets of dairy. And so I had them cut back on dairy, and you see some of that. And I found this interesting article, and my brother laughed at me, but he did it because he had some skin-related issues. And I said, you know what you need to do? Instead of drinking just the regular, you know, Nest tea that you drink, change to oolong tea. And so he started drinking oolong tea, and sure enough, it started to you know, some of the pain and irritation from it started to back off. So, you know, you see this stuff, like you said, in the literature, but you can certainly see it, you know, when you just try some of these things, you know, just cut back on the dairy a little bit and you'll see some changes. It's amazing.
Yes. Many people are allergic to dairy without knowing it. It may not manifest in a bellyache. It does come out in the skin. It's highly correlated with some of our neurodevelopmental disorders too. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And people who are sensitive to gluten are often sensitive to casein as well.
Right.
So I agree with you. I like to get most people off dairy, particularly cow's dairy.
Mm-hmm.
And some people will tolerate goat or sheep dairy just fine.
Yeah.
But if you look around the world, there are very few types of people genetically that can really digest dairy products well, and they're generally from Northern Europe.
Right.
Now I'm going to jump way ahead here. Okay. If when you talk about people from different regions able to extract nutrients from certain foods,
mm-hmm.
You mentioned the Northern Europeans who can tolerate dairy. There's a section of, I think it's Japan or China, where they eat seaweed.
Right.
It's green seaweed. But their bodies genetically can extract the nutrients, where our bodies genetically can't extract the nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Well, I think that it's certainly true that we evolve genetically and we carry those genes no matter where we end up living. We still carry, for example, my ancestors are from Eastern Europe. And so I carry their genes and the ability to digest those foods that they ate, but also the ratios of those foods. We have some flexibility in digesting. For example, yes, we can digest seaweeds. Can we do it? Let's say those of us from Europe, the Irish, for example, grew up on seaweeds too. And so we want to get very location specific too when we think about it. I know we talked, or we were talking a little earlier about whale blubber, for example.
Yes.
Can we extract the nutrients from whale blubber? Well, I probably cannot do that as efficiently as someone who's indigenous to the northern climes, who's mm-hmm. used to eating that. We see this in people, for example, the Pacific Northwest peoples, whose diet was very ketogenically oriented. It wasn't a complete ketogenic, but lots of salmon, lots of game, very few carbohydrates, except as they'd pop up in berries during the summer, for example. And it's hypothesized that they have a particular enzyme in the liver that doesn't work as well to digest oils, because they never needed to digest oils. Their whole diet was pure oil, so they didn't need this enzyme to work. And so now that they're not eating a diet rich in fish oil, the lack of that enzyme is contributing to other health problems like diabetes. They're not meant to be eating soy and bread and all of these things that have come in since contact. So I think there's absolutely truth to that idea that we eat according to where our peoples are from and the kinds of foods they ate.
Wow. We saw a paper about that not long ago where mm-hmm. it was talking about some of those differences. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty interesting. But you were the analogy you gave, or metaphor you gave earlier, about the microbiome in the neighborhood was great. And we've heard people refer to the gut as the second brain. And I think that I even heard that there are more, if I got this right, there are more serotonin receptors in your gut than there are in your brain.
Yes.
That is just difficult to imagine.
Since we're all part of this medical model.
Right.
I know. See, isn't it hard to fathom this? It really is. But Dr. Gershon coined that term, the second brain. And I think our understanding clinically really bears this out, that, for example, when a patient starts Prozac, they can often become nauseated because of the activation of those serotonin receptors. Same thing if they use the natural, what I call the natural amino acid to boost serotonin, 5-HTP, they'll start to feel that nausea. It's the amino acid that will stimulate that neurotransmitter production. Think about what we learned when we trained in the treatment of anxiety and colitis or intestinal inflammatory bowel syndrome. We were taught in the field of mental health that people who had colitis were very anxious. And so we were treating their anxiety by teaching them how to breathe and relax and exploring their anxiety. But lo and behold, we discover that the GABA receptor, the anti-anxiety neurotransmitter, is in the gut. And so when we support that anti-anxiety neurotransmitter in the gut, anxiety goes down. And so this gives us this wonderful tool to not only address the cause of anxiety in the mind, but the cause of anxiety in the body. And it really has opened up a whole avenue of treatment for us to support gut health as a way to influence mental health.
Right. Yeah, that the relationship, and again, I think I mentioned it earlier, is just amazing between, you know, when you have somebody come in and you're talking to them, especially anxiety and depression and some of that stuff, and you're doing that initial visit with them. I was just reminded of this a couple of days ago when I saw a new patient, and we're talking, he's an athlete and he does all this stuff, and we're talking, he's really anxious. He has thoughts that he's having difficulty managing. And we're talking about, you know, lots of anxiety management. And I said, any medical issues, any stomach aches, anything going on with your stomach? And he goes, well, it's strange that you ask, but yeah, I get stomach aches all the time. And he can't really put it together, like how it relates to diet or anything like that. And so I have him sort of keeping a diary over the next couple of weeks so we can see what this relationship is. But more often than not, when a person comes in and they're experiencing, especially anxiety and depression, you see gut problems. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I always ask those questions in the book, the Nutrition Essentials book. I've got a food mood diary. Yeah, and right. I ask my clients to keep a record for 3 days, just that, to begin to make the connections. Again, we're deconditioning that dissociated response and saying, hey, there's a relationship here, and let's heal your gut, and we're going to heal your anxiety at the same time.
Absolutely.
So I agree with you. I think one of the most important things we can do in mental health is take a physical health history.
Yes.
And also ask our clients to demand that.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So go ahead.
We had another question about the two most important. How do you begin? We have these people who, I have a woman now, I'm going to have her come in. She's having memory loss, and she's probably late 50s, maybe. We saw her son. And she's having memory loss. So she's been checked at the Alzheimer's Center, and there's no indication that she really has what we would consider classic dementia. It's not even pre-senile dementia. She's too young, and she has too many other abilities. I think it's her diet. She's, I don't know that I'd call her morbidly obese, but she really is overweight. And I suspect that her diet has something to do with her memory loss.
Mm-hmm.
Safe assumption?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
What mechanism of action there?
Chronic inflammatory response. Okay. Cortisol is called the death hormone because it kills neurons.
Right.
And we know that adipose tissue also holds inflammatory response more. And also, if she's not physically active, then she's not getting her blood and oxygen going to the brain. The brain needs oxygenation. And there's this great saying, what's happening in the heart is happening in the brain.
Right.
And so the other thing that I would think about with her, in addition to diet, is hormones. She's probably menopausal.
Menopausal,
probably if she's in her late 50s. And probably estrogen is highly correlated with memory. We know that women are more vulnerable to dementia in part because of estrogen loss.
Okay.
And not only estrogen, but we see in men too, loss of testosterone related to memory and depression. Okay. And so with someone like this, and even if, for example, if one isn't trained in hormone therapy, I would make a referral for that workup too, so that it becomes really a whole picture of looking at hormones, looking at inflammatory response. And the approach that I take with someone is always adding in something positive and eliminating something negative. And mm-hmm. since we've been talking about inflammation as food, food causing inflammation, I work with clients to reduce the inflammatory foods and add in the anti-inflammatory foods. And one of the most important steps that I take right off the bat that people don't have trouble enacting is I make sure that the fat quality they're taking in is good.
Good, right.
People, I've never had anyone say to me, oh no, I don't want to eat butter.
Right.
But I say, get rid of that canola oil and corn oil and safflower oil. Just go for the virgin olive oil, the good quality butter. Mm-hmm. And people then feel like, oh, I can do this.
Right.
So I want to help them make some changes that they can begin to do.
Right. Now, you mentioned, and I know where you were going with your question, because you were going to ask about, you know, what are some of the early steps that you can...
For those who don't know anything,
right.
You know, they're still eating packaged foods and canned foods, and they just don't know that there is this connection.
Right.
Where do you...
So, and I know where I said, but you mentioned about, you know, referring for a workup, and I'm wondering, are there any particular labs that you tend to recommend for patients to do, like blood work or anything like that? I know I listen to a lot of and read a lot of different people who talk about, you know, organic acid testing and some of that kind of stuff. Do you do any of that, or do you primarily focus on, you know, just looking at what makes sense based upon what's happening with the patient?
It's a very good question, because depending upon the patient and his or her belief system, I might order lab tests right away, because mm-hmm. sometimes they need to see it for themselves,
right,
what their body is telling them. But for some people, we can begin with changing out their oils and fats and educating them about sugar and the brain and giving them alternatives, as you've talked about, for a sweet tooth. And so it really depends. But I like to do what's called a tissue mineral analysis. That's a hair analysis that will give me the level and ratio of minerals in the body. It'll tell me a little bit about how their endocrine system is functioning in terms of the speed of it, whether they're fast or slow, and whether we need to rev up their system with carbohydrates or proteins or slow it down with fats. So I like to do an adrenal stress test. Mm-hmm. And so it really depends on the belief system of the client. And I think this is why we bring in mental health so much to the whole field of nutrition, because we're trained in understanding motivation, beliefs, and how people will adhere to a program in ways that we can really support even nutritional therapists or registered dietitians that may not have that background and understanding. What's going to motivate my client at this point?
Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely.
True.
That's fantastic. I order the adrenal stress test sometimes as well. It's just, especially when there's sleep issues and that kind of stuff, because you have those spikes at 10 o'clock at night and you can't get to sleep, and that contributes to stress, of course. But go ahead.
Well, I wanted to follow on that we know that so many mental health issues are a function of disrupted circadian rhythm.
Yeah.
And not only the light therapy that we use, but we can use nutrients to re-regulate circadian rhythm. For example, B12, mm-hmm, melatonin will help re-regulate the clock. We know in bipolar is essentially a circadian rhythm disruption.
Right.
And so I do a lot of work with my clients with nutrients and foods along with light.
Right.
And we know that our bipolar clients are often very resistant to adhering to medication regimes. And just one more thing, the best, absolute best mineral, and you may be familiar with it, for regulation of circadian rhythm and bipolar is lithium, natural lithium,
right,
mineral.
Mm-hmm.
And so just sometimes a couple of nutrients in my client's repertoire of what they're doing makes a big difference.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize that lithium is just a salt. It's just, you know, it's naturally in the earth and it's
sodium,
there.
Potassium, lithium.
Right. So
yes, indeed.
Yeah.
So as a matter of fact, near where I live up in Seattle, we've got wonderful Mount Rainier, which has lithium-rich mineral springs.
Wow.
That the local native people called laughing springs.
Uh-huh.
Because you sit in it and you giggle.
Right.
Just lifts your mood.
Well, you know, that brings to mind, there's a pediatrician in Georgia who is now 101 and she's still practicing. And she was interviewed about the treatments that she used back in the day, for treatment of ADHD,
mm-hmm,
and it was magnesium.
Mm-hmm.
It's all take a magnesium bath, and how to treat ear infections, and how to treat ADHD, and how to treat all these things. And she said, we did not have any medicines,
right,
in those days. And she uses these same things. And so children who are treatment resistant to medications are brought to her,
right,
for these alternative treatments.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Indeed, I got back recently from a trip to Cuba where we did an exchange with a group of us in integrative medicine for mental health. And what made me think of it is that they also in Cuba have not had a lot of medications as well. And so what was interesting is how they got to the use of herbs and nutrients by not having medications. And in many ways, where we are in the United States now, is we're getting to it because of the effects of medications.
Right. Yeah.
Two very different routes, but really coming up with very similar conclusions.
Well, because Bernie and I
spent most of our times in medical, most of our years in medical school, especially the early years, and we were trained in using medications. As we have practiced over the years, we have moved more and more away.
Yeah.
But we were advocates of medication. Now we're less so.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And we're looking for these alternative treatments.
Well, and as you think about it, you know, what people don't understand also is that, you know, most of these medications, especially psychotropic medications and medications for mental health conditions in general, were not around before basically the decade of the 1950s. Mm-hmm. You know, prior to that time, you know, there weren't really any of these. I mean, antipsychotics came out around that time. Antidepressants came out around that time. So prior to that time, we were doing all kinds of other things to treat these conditions and treat these issues. So,
yes.
Yeah.
And I think what happened is not that it wasn't working. It's that the idea of progress and efficiency took over. You mm-hmm. know, the idea of baths. When I did some of my early internship, I worked in a geriatric ward at a public health hospital in Boston. And nurses are always in the forefront of touch. And so they said to me, why don't you, you know, and I was showing them how to rock people to relax them. They said, well, instead of giving our afternoon round of Librium to these elderly schizophrenic patients, why don't you rock them? And I, you know, I had a wonderful time just going to their beds and rocking them to sleep each 15, 20 minutes. Now, that works. That helps someone relax and reduce anxiety, but it's not particularly efficient. It's not as efficient as a benzodiazepine. And so I think a lot of it is not that these things work better. It's that our whole society and our approach to healing has changed.
Right. So to get to the question that we were going to ask, like, 30 minutes ago, what are sort of the two most important first steps that a person can take to improve their mood with their diet and improve their mood with their food?
Here's what I tell my clients. Mood follows food.
Yeah.
And the most important first step you can take is to balance your blood glucose. And so I educate my clients, and that's where the food mood diary comes in too, to watch how their mood changes and their energy changes after they eat. Do they spike up after they drink coffee and sugar and then crash and feel upset and irritable? And this goes the same for children too. While sugar doesn't cause ADHD, it certainly doesn't help it. And for some children, they're especially vulnerable. If you've got a child who needs to be eating eggs and bacon in the morning and they're eating cereal and milk, they're more likely to bounce off the wall than the child who can tolerate a little bit better the cereal. And so that's where the individuality comes in. And so I encourage my clients to do a 7-day carbohydrate sugar detox and then come tell me how their mood is. And inevitably, they tell me they feel more stable. It takes 2 to 3 days to come off the sugar addiction, but I give them permission to eat as much meat and fat. They can have a couple of servings of vegetables and 1 serving of fruit. I encourage them to have 1 sweet potato with plenty of raw butter and salt. Salt's very good for the adrenal glands, and the sweet will be satisfying as they're coming off of sugar, but it will still allow them to stabilize their mood. And inevitably they come in 7 days later saying, wow, I never realized how much what I was doing was affecting the up and down I feel throughout the day. And I do this not only with people who are depressed and anxious or with focus or concentration issues, but even with people with the diagnosis of bipolar, because we don't know the percentage of influence of food on their mood lability. And so that's the first step I do with clients.
Great. Now, so when you're working with your patients, and I'm sure that you get this because I know that we do as well, you know, the first thing that they say as soon as we start talking about it, they say, well, you know, I don't know how to cook like that. I don't know how to prepare food like that. I don't know how to pick what's, but what are your recommendations for folks who are experiencing that?
I've got two recommendations, and you're welcome to share some of the recipes in the Nutrition Essentials book too, because I wrote this for people. I travel the country teaching, and 50% of the people in the audience raise their hands when I say, who here cooks? It's really a lost art. So you're right. People don't either know how to cook or don't have the time to cook. And so I teach them about getting a slow cooker, because you can cook almost anything in a slow cooker and not know how to cook. You can buy a slow cooker for $30, and I teach them get a whole chicken and get some onions and garlic and some celery and vegetables, throw it into the slow cooker, turn it on slow, and come back 8 hours later, you've got a delicious meal, add a little salt and parsley. Or maybe I teach them about beef or beef bones. You know, there's been a lot of myths that are taking people away from eating eggs or eating butter or even eating red meat. But depending upon the individual, whether they're a carnivore, whether they're a vegetarian, or whether they're somewhere in between, you can get very good, nourishing, anti-stress food. As a matter of fact, I had a client the other day who said, you know, I work at an office, I can't eat during the day. I said, make a bone broth in that slow cooker, put it in a thermos, and you're allowed to sip at your desk, aren't you? She said, yes, and you can have that nourishing broth. And the other thing that I teach people is to make a smoothie. And they can make a smoothie. They don't need to know how to cook. And then I really serve as a cooking coach with them. I walk them through step by step how to enhance their food preparation skills. Or I send them to a cooking class. Yeah. And if they're lonely in particular, it's a great way to meet people.
I love the slow cooker idea. You're absolutely right. That is really, and I never thought of it that way before, but it is an absolutely, I mean, a child can do it. I just throw stuff in a pot and let it go.
Yes.
Yeah, I never thought of it.
Okay. Well, so you walk your patients through every step of the process, it sounds. I mean, you really supply them with all the tools necessary, from looking at their diet, looking at how the relationship between their diet and their mood, and then how to remedy it into the kitchen.
Yes. And also, what's getting in the way? What are the obstacles? Do we need to bring the whole family in to get on board? Or I had a client recently, we've been working together for a couple of years. She's made very good progress, but she's still not doing food prep. And I said, you know, what is it? What's getting in the way of this? And she became teary, and she said, when I was younger, I was involved in a very serious kitchen accident in which my sister was terribly burned. And I was banished from the kitchen, and I've never gone back since. And so sometimes there are emotional issues. When I talk with a client, how come you don't want to sit down with your family at night? Well, you know, when I grew up, all there was fighting and bickering at the table. And so again, I think we are really poised to not only support our clients, but understand and help them kind of get to what's underneath the obstacle that keeps them from going and achieving what their goals are.
Absolutely. And I know that, you know, it's challenging with some of the patients and for some people, because they, as you were just describing with those examples, some of the decisions that we make related to that are rooted in childhood. I mean, it's just been part of who you are. You know, I eat this kind of food because that's the kind of food that we've always eaten in my family. And they're so resistant to giving it up, and because they don't really see themselves as themselves without that food. And so it's
nowhere is that more true than in the South, or truer than in the South.
It's really true.
I've lived all over the country, and I've never seen a people cling to their dietary habits as they do in the South. Mm-hmm. You can't convince them not to cook vegetables until there's nothing left. They cook them and cook them and cook them, and they said, that's just the way we do it here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one of the things that people in those kinds of situations they turn to, are like supplements. Mm-hmm. Should we be thinking about supplements? I've heard both ways that, you know, you look at individual supplements and vitamins and micronutrients and things like that, that you can look at individual ones and use supplement as needed. And then I've heard others say that, well, we're really not made to take individual supplements, because if you take calcium supplements, you also need to make sure that you have magnesium and some of these other things to sort of go along with that delivery system. Do you recommend supplements, and do you recommend people really monitoring how many vitamins and minerals and micronutrients and things like that that they take? Or is it just, hey, let's just fix your diet and that will fix those problems?
I do recommend supplements, and I tell my clients that food is essential, but it's not sufficient.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Especially when we're working with significant mental or physical illness. There are alternatives to benzodiazepines, but a celery, which is a natural sedative plant, will not go up against a benzodiazepine addiction.
Right.
So we first have to help people reduce some of the toxins, mm-hmm. The drugs, whatever they're addicted to, and then allow their bodies to respond. And so, yes, I think there's definitely a role for sometimes even mega supplementation. If mm-hmm. you're working with someone with psychosis, yes, we know that there's a very high correlation between gluten sensitivity and psychosis. But there's also phospholipid metabolism issues in the brain. There are significant issues that can only be addressed by perhaps fish oil or gamma-linolenic acid, certain enzymes. We know that even dementia, there's a third type of dementia now that's been identified being related to low zinc levels. You talked about micronutrients. We know that excess copper in the body that is often a result of drinking well water that's high in copper can contribute to depression. And if there's a copper-zinc imbalance, I don't want to get too technical, but I think there's really very good evidence for supplementation, but I don't think you can supplement off the internet. I think you need to have a professional work with you, just like you mentioned magnesium. Too much magnesium. You need magnesium for good muscle function, for anti-anxiety. We know those Epsom salt baths really work to help you sleep. But if you take too much supplemental magnesium, you can become depressed mm-hmm. just from the magnesium. So it really does take knowledge about what your individual body needs to get the best out of the supplementation.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. And there's been some recent papers, and I'm you know, it's kind of hit in different ways. But you know, looking at, you know, the omega-3s, for example, how significant it is, not just in mood, but also with schizophrenia. Right. That there was that recent report that came out that said, you know, good doses of omega-3s, you know, decreases psychotic episodes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's amazing the effects that these, again, the ongoing argument that your diet and what you're eating has no effect on your mental health really doesn't hold very much.
No. And indeed, let's take that example a step further. In order to break down the omega-3s, your liver needs to be able to be functioning well, and your gallbladder. And what's one of our big epidemics in the United States? We take people's gallbladder out. They can't then store the bile and emulsify these fats. Mm-hmm. And what are we serving people who are homeless and psychotic and on the streets? We're serving them all kinds of mashed potatoes and peas and gluten glob, right?
We're
not helping them a whole lot. And so with these clients, I want to help them eat, for example, bitter greens. Mm-hmm. You mentioned beets. Beets are the preeminent food for the gallbladder. You cannot beat beets as a food and beet greens.
Is that true for the beet and the greens?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Love beet greens.
Very, very, they're the best food for the gallbladder and for depression and mood because they support the methylation process and the detoxification process in the body.
So if we ate pickled beets, we get two for the price of one.
Absolutely.
So we get
fermentation. Or if you put some,
Right. Right.
We top it off with some yogurt like my people do and voila, you're in, you've got a great meal in front of you.
I'll be working on that this week.
Will you bring me some pickled beets?
I will bring, I'm going to get some fermented beets. Yes.
Fermented beets. I've never had that before.
Yeah. They're good.
They're very good. And you know, I just wanted to follow up on one thing you said about helping our clients. I had a client not long ago who loves his hot dogs.
Yes.
Loves his Planters peanuts. I'm not going to talk to him about soaking almonds and eating kombucha, drinking.
Right.
That's just not going to be congruent with him. But I could talk to him about getting a better quality hot dog and getting a fresh made sauerkraut at the farmer's market rather than the store-bought so that he's not running out of my office screaming, get me out of here. But he's like, oh, I could do that. And so I think we nudge people step by step in making these changes that are going to be aligned with their current practice.
Yeah, if you do stuff like that, they're going to run screaming, you know, she grew up in the 70s. What do you expect?
Right.
One of those.
Yeah. No wheatgrass for me.
That's right. Oh, my God. I forgot about wheatgrass.
But it's so true because that is the aversion that so many people have is that you're wanting me to change everything that is me. Right. And it is so much at one time because I think a lot of professionals say, well, these are all, here's the list of all the things you need to do. And if you don't do it, then you're not going to get healthy. And people are going to walk out and say, well, you know, I can't make all those changes.
And the obverse is also true. There are some people that I will say just that too. You know what? You're really ill. You've got a lot of problems. And unless you get on board with this, you're not going to get better.
Yeah.
And so that's where we use our skills as therapists, whether we read the Riot Act or whether we nudge people along and, you know, whether we really do help people wake up and see what's going on.
Right. Absolutely. Yep. Well, I don't know if you guys realize this, but we've been talking for well over an hour now, and I hate to keep you any longer, though there are we've only got through like maybe half of chapter one. There's so much more that we could talk about, but are there any last recommendations or thoughts or anything that you wanted to offer the listeners before we let you go?
Oh, well, thank you. First of all, thanks for the great conversation. And I think that the major recommendation I have is that I promise you, and this is what I tell my clients, if you change your diet, if you improve your diet, you'll get better. It's a matter of chemistry.
Right.
And it's just like, one of the reasons I love to clean my house, it's such a great break from all the intellectual work and the clinical work because I know I'm going to begin and end and I can be assured of accomplishing my goal.
Right.
No doubt about it. And it's the same with diet. There's no question that changing diet is going to improve your mental health. And the first step is changing and improving your oils. And getting off the sugar and onto the anti-inflammatory foods like frozen blueberries in a smoothie, frozen cherries. And one last thing, and I've got a blog on this, cherries are known to stimulate melatonin in the brain. They're a wonderful fruit to eat at night if you want to go to sleep. Right. And so those are just a few last minute thoughts as we wind up together.
Great. And you know, I was going to say it earlier, and then I was like, well, no, moment passed. But, you know, when you talk about oils, Richard and I have laughed about this before, but I stopped gluten and most dairy some time ago, and I drink, you know, a cup or four of coffee in the mornings. But instead of putting cream or anything like that in there, I put about a tablespoon of coconut oil
in
my coffee, and it is – there was a period of time that I was doing it and everything was great. And then I ran out here at the office. So I wasn't doing it for a little while. I kept forgetting to get it. And I started noticing things changing. Like I was getting really tired in the afternoons. And I was thinking that there was something that I was doing that was messing me up. I wasn't sleeping well or something. And then the next week I finally got my coconut oil again and started doing it again. And that sleepiness went away. And it was a very almost one-to-one correlation of I was using it, everything was fine. I stopped using it and I was having mm-hmm. problems, and I started using it again and the problems went away. And you know, that importance of good, healthy oils, avocado oil, right, is really mm-hmm. good.
Yes.
Coconut oil, mm-hmm. extra virgin olive oil. Those are really good oils that we should be using.
And there's good evidence, for example, for your client in the one in her late 50s, there's very good evidence for coconut oil and the brain and memory and as a Alzheimer's prevention. Mm-hmm. So that would be a good thing for her to get on as well. Well, I'll tell you what. When my new book, The Good Mood Kitchen, comes out in September, let's get back together and
Absolutely.
Some more.
Perfect.
Absolutely. That'd be great.
Yep.
So, and in the meantime, I know you've got tropical fruit, but if you decide you want some local avocados and papaya, y'all come on down to Mexico.
to the dry jungle.
That's right.
We could take a little dry air right now.
Oh, yeah. Incredibly humorous.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. So great to spend this time together.
Absolutely. And so we'll definitely get back in touch and talk when the next book comes out.
All right. And I've got the other book, the Eat Right, Feel Right book, on its way to you.
Great.
So I think you'll enjoy some of those recipes too.
Awesome. Will awesome. Do. Fantastic. Thank you so much. And
my pleasure.
Enjoy your time down there, and we'll be back in touch.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.